This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. For Women's History Month, a conversation now about gender and the law. Here's Catherine T. Bartlett of Duke University.
As an institution, law has both helped to implement and constrained feminist agendas. The law's guarantee of equality enabled feminists to articulate differences in the law's treatment of men and women and provided a structure through which feminists could pursue legal change. In examining the theoretical foundations of law, however, feminists have discovered that the mechanisms of legal reform are self-limiting, allowing change only to a point and even strengthening the roots of gender hierarchy that feminists seek to challenge. Understanding these constraints can help to explain why legal reform has achieved less for women than feminists had expected, and can inform future feminist strategies.
Catherine T. Bartlett is a professor at Duke University. In just a moment, she'll talk about gender and the law. Later on Soundings this week, Susan Porter Benson of the University of Missouri will be here to discuss women, work, and American department stores. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Catherine T. Bartlett is a professor of law at Duke University. She specializes in issues related to gender and the law. She notes that in recent years, the trend in American legal culture has been away from the enactment of laws based strictly on biological definitions or constraints. But even though recent laws may not refer to sex or biology, they still can incorporate what Catherine Bartlett calls gendered assumptions. I asked her to reflect on the interplay among sex, gender, and cultural expectations.
It used to be common to restrict women's activities in the law as a result of pregnancy. Back in 1873, the Supreme Court justified women's exclusion from various occupations on the basis that they had the capacity and, in fact, the calling to become pregnant and to become wives and mothers, and thus had no business, in this 1873 case, no business being lawyers. The same kind of reasoning, what's been called in the law the separate spheres ideology, has been behind many historical exclusions of women from various occupations, and often this is linked back to pregnancy. Now, as the law has developed, it's gone through a number of stages, each of which recognize a different relationship between the fact of pregnancy and the law.
That sounds like the same kind of logic that would drive the distinction between black and white people, the different spheres kind of thing. Is that a bad or a good analogy?
There's a lot of resistance in the law, despite the attractiveness of certain analogies between race and sex. There's a lot of resistance to drawing those analogies on both sides, both on the part of historically oppressed races and on the part of women. Women have tended to be more friendly to those analogies than members of minority races. There are definitely some similarities. The problem is in lumping racism and sexism together, the special problems related to the heritage of slavery and the continuing institutionalization of racism, which are of a somewhat different sort than the basic the ways we institutionalize sexism, are sometimes lost. So generally now it's preferred to discuss the issue separately. It is possible in discussing either issue to ignore important dimensions of the other.
So what we should do is use the operative term should be discrimination or exclusion rather than something specific like sex or race.
Yes, and always in multiples. So we should be talking about various types of exclusions. And that's what the project that I'm working on now attempts to divide the relationship between law and gender into many different perspectives so that we can see that the law and gender operate not just in one way any mm-hmm. more than racism has a kind of single explanation. Rather, there are a number of different kinds of interactions between law and gender, and it's important that they operate together, and it's important to understand them not as part of one grand theory, but rather as different aspects of related problems.
Let me put a couple of other concrete examples in front of you, Kate Bartlett. When we talk about the United States Armed Forces, the military, we have the issue of gays in the military, whether they belong there, whether they should be there legitimately, openly, and we have the question of sexual harassment. Tell me about the relationship between gender and the law as we approach those two very volatile subjects.
Well, that's a big question. I think it is useful to focus on the military, which has been one of the male enclaves in the society, and one of the ways that society has expressed what it means to be a man and what it means, women being excluded, to be a woman. You raise those issues together, I assume, because currently there are debates going on of great interest to the legal community relating both to whether or not gays and lesbians ought to be allowed to be in the military, and then questions of sexual harassment that have arisen not only in workplaces generally, but specifically in the military. To take the issue of gays and lesbians in the military first, we would not ordinarily, at least on the surface, even see that as a problem of sexual discrimination, because the law acts the same as to women as it does to men. That is, same-sex women, a woman who's a lesbian would be treated the same as a gay male. So we wouldn't see a differential treatment between men and women, so we wouldn't call it sex discrimination.
And yet there seems to be a difference in the treatment.
Am I right? Even if there isn't a treatment, one of the important perspectives in looking at the relationship between gender and law is what Catherine MacKinnon has called the dominance perspective.
Huh.
And what that perspective does is focus us in not on differences in treatment specifically, but more various kinds of structural manners in which it's sexuality is defined in ways which subordinate women to men. And the exclusion of gays and lesbians from the military, exclusions based on sexual preference altogether, while not specifically treating men differently from women or women differently from men, reinforce a kind of gender role. Gays and lesbians challenge the notion that sex means male aggressor, female passivity, female mm-hmm. being a sexual object for the benefit of man's pleasure, which is very threatening to the kind of definitions of sexuality which have helped to perpetuate male dominance. So the exclusion of gays from military, while not on the surface an issue of sexual harassment, really does illustrate one of the newer perspectives in looking at gender and law that I think is quite helpful in understanding how even neutral rules can act in ways that reinforce gender dominance.
Now, how is the law changing? I mean, how is the law going to respond to this terrible knot of problems? I mean, are we going to look at one's sexual orientation? Are we going to look at the function that one is supposed to serve in the military? What really is going to take the high ground here and determine the outcome of cases like this? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, I think we were going to mention sexual harassment too, which I think helps to answer that question. Sexual harassment now has gotten a lot of attention, particularly since the Hill-Thomas hearings, and it has been a special problem in the military, as you know. It's come up in a way that I think has helped jar loose some traditional ways of thinking, in particular this way that I've just mentioned, this structural bias against gays and lesbians. The question has, sexual harassment is there is presently, I think, it's fair to say, a backlash against claims about sexual harassment. We get lots of editorial cartoons and comments in the workplace of the
right.
type that would suggest that this is all very trivial. You get comments like, I wish I could tell you how nice you look today, but I'm afraid you'd accuse me of sexual harassment. So a lot of this has been trivialized. On the other hand, it seems to be a plausible comment that someone might make in opposition to allowing gays in the military, that I would be uncomfortable. I'm going to be threatened if a gay man looks at me in a certain way in the shower. I shouldn't have to be subjected to that sort of humiliation, which is, of course, exactly what women, before the time that sexual harassment was understood to be a form of sex discrimination, were expected to put up with in the workplace. They were expected to be objects of the male gaze, and they were expected to be pretty and beautiful and to be judged on their appearance and so on, and they were expected to be looked at. I expect that the convergence of these two issues on the public agenda right now will be quite helpful,
mm-hmm.
Because one is in a sense the flip side of the other, and one helps us to understand the other problem. And it's those sorts of conjunctions that I think lead to new ways of thinking. What I expect we're going to get is a unified policy against sexual harassment, both by heterosexuals and by homosexuals in the military. We get to see that these problems are related, and the more connections we make as a society in those regards, the more advances we can make.
Kate Bartlett, let me become personal for a moment. You have children. You have three kids. Two of them are little girls. What do you want for your little girls as you look at, again, this very grand relationship between gender and the law?
Well, Wayne, that takes me outside my usual academic context. I guess I worry more about my boy in this respect than my girls. For my girls, I want them to have a critical enough perspective to understand and interact with their culture in ways which don't kind of co-opt their own decision-making and their own autonomy, a problem that I think women of my generation have had, not being sure who we are because we get such consistent messages about who we're supposed to be that we don't get around to discovering what sort of person we'd like to make ourselves into using our own criteria. For my son, he's the one who gives me the most trouble about the direction of my career and my so-called feminism. And I see in him some of the roots of backlash that I worry so much about in our society, and the sense that he and others like him have that something is being taken away from them. I'm glad that he appreciates that fact, that something is being taken away from him, but that somehow too much attention, too many benefits are being shifted from one to the other, and not having been part of the historical system of discrimination that he may or may not appreciate has existed in the past, it seems to him that maybe he's going to be the next part of the next set of victims. So I think that understanding how this feels from each perspective is going to be important to any meaningful social growth.
Kate Bartlett, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are a professor of law at Duke University. You're here at our Humanities Center working on a project on tradition and the law. Little Brown is bringing out your new book, Gender and Law, Theory, Doctrine, and Commentary. Kate, thanks for helping with Soundings. Good luck in your work.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. For Women's History Month, a conversation now about women, work, and American department stores. I'll talk with Susan Porter Benson of the University of Missouri at Columbia.
I'd say that work in the United States in general doesn't have a healthy future. The clerking sisterhood exists in what you might call a vestigial form, but it exists very much against the odds. What's interesting is that it does exist against the odds, but the tendency toward part-time, temporary contract work in the United States, as you see it in the department store, is overwhelming. It's pervasive. And I think that the history of work as satisfying human activity in the United States is not a very promising one.
Historian Susan Porter Benson. Her most recent book is Counter Cultures, a study of saleswomen, managers, and customers in American department stores between 1890 and 1940.
According to Susan Porter Benson, the American economy since the turn of the 20th century has emphasized the delivery of services rather than the manufacture of goods, a configuration in which the department store takes center stage. I asked Susan Porter Benson to begin her discussion on a personal note by way of recollecting her childhood visits to Kaufman's department store in Pittsburgh.
Well, I think it's relevant that I actually grew up in a small town near Pittsburgh, and so going to Kaufman's was for me a visit to the big city. It meant an encounter with a certain amount of glamour, a certain amount of freedom, abundance, all that was there, floors and floors and floors of it covering over a city block.
A chicken a la King lunch?
A chicken a la King lunch. That was the centerpiece of the day.
Now, that was when you were a kid. Tell me about your life as a historian. How'd you get interested in the department store?
I was primarily interested in a study of work. That is, not so much traditional labor history, unions, strikes, that sort of thing. I was much more interested in figuring out what people did on a daily basis, what their work consisted of.
Is this what you historians call history from the bottom up, as it were? The sort of, not the trivial, I don't mean to say
no,
that.
I didn't think you did.
But the, you know, what traditionally has been viewed as the unimportant in historical studies.
I guess I'd say less that it was history from the bottom up than that it was history from both ends, because I was very interested in the interaction between the people who are at the bottom of the occupational organizational heap in the department store and their relationship with the people who were above them in the hierarchy and with customers who were above them in the class structure.
How do you, why and how do you make this triangulation, Sue Benson? The department store, the floor of the store, as you call it, saleswomen and management. How does that interplay work?
Well, it seems to me that you can't understand what the work of the saleswomen was like unless you can understand social interaction, because that was the very essence of the saleswoman's work. And the social interaction that saleswomen experienced was very much conditioned by this three-way this three-way encounter. They were controlled, managed, hired, etc., by the managers. They were trying to persuade to sell to the customers. And each of those two-way relationships builds into a very complicated triangle.
Now, we go back to what, about 1850 for these origins. And we have a counterpoint, don't we, Sue, between the sort of cold, large, big company and that which is really familiar locally and a part of the local society.
Well, that's the big conflict that department store managers experienced. On the one hand, they're businessmen, and they are just as concerned to turn up good balance sheets, to maximize efficiency, to act like real businessmen and, quote, industrialists, if you will, as anyone. But they're also concerned with culture.
You used to hear conversations around the dinner table about pleasing the customer, figuring out what's trendy and what really is going to be the staple of the store. These are the concerns that these people had.
Yeah. And in a way, those concerns are immediate and pervasive in department stores in a way that they really aren't for manufacturing firms.
What do you mean in your book on American department stores by the phrase, an Adamless Eden? Here we're going to talk about gender and the department store floor.
Well, that's the phrase I use to title a chapter about customers' experiences in the department store. And it's a phrase that came from one of the Filenes, one of the pillars of the great Boston, now National Department Store. And it is as many things are in thinking about the world of the department store, it's a two-sided sort of image, an Adamless Eden. It was a woman's world in that the vast majority of customers, 10 out of 11, 11 out of 12, were women. But it was a world in which men continued to call the shots. All the top executive positions, with very few exceptions that don't change it, were men. Many of the department managers or buyers were women, but they were always subject to the men at the tip of the executive hierarchy. There, the Eden image is also a wonderful kind of two-sided image. On the one hand, it's paradise, yet on the other hand, it contains the seeds of a kind of gender subordination. Uh-huh. And this is very much the case for women in the department store.
It also contained the seeds of a kind of flourishing for a role for women that we now really kind of take for granted, do we not? Tell me about that.
Well, the notion of women as consumers is one of the great cliches of the study of social history. And I think it's one that's not been examined carefully enough at all. What seems to be fairly clear is that women do most of the spending. What's not very clear is how the decisions to make those expenditures are made, who actually controls the money. And once you factor in those questions, I think you find that women might be doing the ultimate act of consuming, but they aren't necessarily the ones who are in control of it.
It's not too far a leap between the very intensely personal psychological dimensions of consumers and consumerism to these kind of cold sociological stereotypes that we have about what drives the department store. Is this a form of feminism in retrospect, going back and sort of making the case for the importance of women in a marketplace where they traditionally were not recognized as having that important a role? Mm.
I wouldn't call it feminism.
What would you call it?
I would call it an attempt to understand gender relations. Uh-huh. It's different. Feminism usually implies a more organized effort to further the interests of women as women.
Why do you say, Sue Benson, that, as you call them, shop girls and saleswomen were made and not born?
During the late 19th century, but in a much more intensified form in the 20th century, department store managers decided that they needed their saleswomen to be much more effective on the selling floor. The original notion of a saleswoman or a shop girl was that she was merely a set of hands, a set of hands that conveyed items from the storage cabinets to the customers, a set of hands that took the money and gave the change, almost a human machine. Hmm. But department store managers soon discovered that for a number of reasons, it was important to have trained saleswomen.
One of those reasons was to get people to buy more than they thought that they were going to buy when they walked into the store. So what else is new?
Well, department stores were very much like railroads. Uh-huh. They had very high fixed expenses. These giant, elaborately designed stores that are built after the turn of the century cost an enormous amount to maintain. You had to keep them open all the time, every part of them. And if you could turn one sale into many sales, if you could convince a woman to buy not just a pair of shoes, but a handbag, a set of sheets, perhaps some handkerchiefs, ribbons, laces, perhaps a chafing dish, then what you were doing was maximizing the return on your fixed investment.
You've also got a kind of a dynamic in terms of American class at work here, because these so-called, in your words, shop girls, saleswomen, didn't really come from the same social stratum as the people to whom they were making the pitch, and yet they wanted to sound and act like the sort of upper class, but they weren't.
Well, most of the saleswomen were, in fact, working class women. It was an occupation that required a minimum of literacy, a minimum of numeracy, and a veneer of genteel culture. It did not require any education in special skills, and therefore it was not a very highly paid occupation. Hence, working class women were attracted into it.
Sue Benson, what do you mean by a public space for women? What do department stores have to do with that kind of language?
Well, for the women who were customers in department stores, the stores were places in which they could move freely in public. And for bourgeois women at the time, to be in public was to be in some way compromised. But department stores offered women the kind of facilities in public, in central business districts, that were provided for men by their places of business, or for elite men by city clubs, for working class men by saloons, but department stores provided women with restrooms, not just in the sense of toilet facilities, but lounges. They provided them with writing tables with stationery stamped with the store's crest. They often provided such what we would consider such frivolities as daycare for children. Some stores had registered nurses in charge of children. Other stores had small zoos, amusement parks for children.
In other words, what goes around comes around.
Precisely.
We had a way for women to be, to assume a public presence in a way that was acceptable without necessarily intending an enlarging of that role for women.
Yes, and even in the department store, the woman was not completely a free agent because she was beset by saleswomen, managed by the policies of managers, and it's interesting that this free space for women was very much a commercialized space. It wasn't a municipal space, such as a park or a museum.
In other words, it fit into our corporate social structure.
Absolutely.
And therefore made sense.
Absolutely.
Susan Porter Benson, I want to thank you for coming by to contribute to Soundings. Your book is Counter Cultures, Saleswomen, Managers, and Customers in American Department Stores, 1890 to 1940. That's a mouthful. University of Illinois Press. Thanks for coming by to be on Soundings. Good luck in your work.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
It's Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guests were Catherine T. Bartlett of Duke University and Susan Porter Benson of the University of Missouri at Columbia. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 650. That's program number 650, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, part two of Soundings for Women's History Month. Lynn Roller of the University of California will be here to discuss mother goddesses in the ancient Mediterranean world. And Gino Barr of Duke University will be here with commentary about women's studies in contemporary higher education. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Gender and the Law, Women and the World of Work, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For Women's History Month, join me for conversations with Catherine Bartlett of Duke University and Susan Porter Benson of the University of Missouri. Catherine Bartlett will be here to discuss gender and American legal culture. Susan Porter Benson will talk about countercultures, her history of women, work, and American department stores. Gender and the Law,
Women and the World of Work, this week on Soundings.